Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
Hello, everybody. I'm Eric Klein.
And I'm Paul Riesbendel.
On this edition of the show, we're looking at the origins of public radio in the United States, including the important role that college and university-based stations played in the development of public radio. Josh Shepard joins to talk about his new book, Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Josh is an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and is director of the Radio Preservation Task Force at the Library of Congress. Josh, we're so excited to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me.
So your book covers a lot of ground as far as setting up the confluence of ideas and constituents that eventually lead to the creation of public radio. So I wanted to start and just ask you about what prompted you to dive into this aspect of the history.
Yeah, I had originally come from philosophy, and I had studied like public sphere theory and phenomenology and a lot of Marxism and social theory. And I was sort of eminently interested in these questions about what a public means, even beyond, you know, the political nature of a public. But when I went to Wisconsin for graduate school, they had a lot of the data or evidence regarding the history of where the public came from in the U.S. You know, the origins of non-commercial media papers are basically split between Wisconsin and University of Maryland. And so, I became really interested in the logistics about how concepts of a public good or public service in the U.S. were translated into the material practices that we associate with the institutions.
And I mean, you're sort of starting to answer this. These are huge questions. I probably shouldn't even start with such huge questions, but maybe like in a very succinct way, why do you think public radio is such a rich area for this type of study?
So yeah, one of the distinctions I try to make in the book is that, you know, public media is a unique set of genres. It's a unique policy history in its own way, but it is fundamentally different than commercial media in one basic way. And that is commercial media is loyal to what we would call like a logics of accumulation. In other words, it's an advertising system. Everything that it does anticipates audience behaviors, and it tries to profit off of speculating who the listeners might be and then selling that information to commercial broadcasters. So that they have that down pretty sound within sort of a very narrow range of chance. They're very likely going to make that money back with the content that they produce. Public media is a mission statement-based approach to serving democratic participation. And it comes out of education in this country historically. And then it also is concerned with not reaching a wide audience or niche audience for, you know, selling information to advertisers, but reaching the smallest possible audience or constituency in terms of localism or in terms of public service, as I mentioned before. So it's basically something that is not supposed to reach big audiences or make money. And that is a fundamental philosophical difference between the institutional approaches.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. And I think we're going to get more into that nitty gritty. I want to start by asking some specific questions about the early days. And you start the book with, to me anyway, some really tantalizing stories about the early days of educational radio. And, you know, that's something of personal interest to me, the very early years of college radio. So I'm excited that you were touching on that, what was happening at university-based stations, the 1920s, for example. So maybe from your perspective, you know, why are university-based stations such an important part of this history of public radio?
Yeah, so public radio in the U.S. Is distinct from other public systems. So, for example, the BBC began with the post office, right? It was a totally different locational start. Public media in the U.S. Comes out of educational broadcasting and educational radio. And the origins of that are actually compulsory education. And compulsory education just refers to state laws that you got to go to school. It's that simple. But in the way this country implemented those, they start in the 1950s in Massachusetts with those laws. And then it doesn't actually fulfill every state until roughly 1918 with Mississippi. So in other words, not every state mandated that you had to have an education until the last 100 years. It's a really recent phenomenon in this country. And they were fundamentally interested, once those laws were in place, with reaching every student, especially in rural areas. So the basics are that, you know, let's say you have farmers that are 30 miles from a campus, you know, in Iowa or something like that. How do you have a night class for someone who has to traverse 30 miles on a horse in 1924, you know, after they've worked 10 hours in the field or something like that? And radio just made totally natural sense in its emergence, which is 1920, 1921 or so, depending on who you talk to, as a strategy for distance learning. So it was essentially a correspondence, adult education, distance learning strategy that was implemented by chance with the adult education programs that start to develop in the 1900s. So a lot of the origins of public media are actually in instructional media that were meant to reach these types of audiences who couldn't otherwise have a campus within their reach. And so you get like cooking shows, you know, but they were called home economics back then. You know, you get travelogues, you get, you know, the prototype for Anthony Bourdain on cable, you know, television is actually, you know, what is it like to live in France or something like that? You know, it doesn't matter. You get math programming. So in other words, a lot of the programming genres that we associate with public media and even parts of community media have their origins in instructional extension services from the universities themselves.
And what, so if we think about these very early stations in the 1920s, are there a lot based at universities? And then within that, you know, category of station, are many of them doing this instructional programming? Is it a subset? I'm just curious, like, how widespread that was.
So yeah, there were very few schools that sort of hit the ground running with this from the top down, like a president of a university mandating some kind of extension services. It was actually a very early form of educational technology that would have come out of a department like engineering or physics at first, because they were experimenting with radio waves. And then they would realize, okay, if we're going to reach local listeners, what would a public service model that's useful for them be? And so I went to Wisconsin for grad school, and there's a town called Baraboo, about 35, I don't know, miles north, but it's like this tornado alley. So one of the earliest broadcasters in Wisconsin often makes the case that it started in 1917 during World War I. But one of the earliest broadcast strategies is to tell farmers that there's a tornado coming, for example. That was an early form of public service media. Or like, what are, you know, the pork belly prices today? You know, just like reporting so they knew where to sell or when not to sell. And so a lot of the early public service approaches really do have what we would call like a localist model. You know, here's some economic information, here's some weather information. And so the universities were, you know, at first at least experimental with these kinds of broadcasts. And then they realized that the same listeners might actually benefit from the correspondence classes, and that they could just, you know, mail their tests in and have them graded and sent back and get credit and all these kinds of things. So what you see really by the early 1920s is a buy-in from education departments, early form, and the National Education Association in particular was very interested in visual instruction strategies and saw auditory instruction as an extension of that. And so by 1921 or so, certain flagship Big Ten universities, we'd call them now, you know, Midwestern, so Ohio State, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa State became the great experimentors of how to reach their communities within state mandates. They had more funding from their states than other states did. By and large, though, a lot of universities were pretty piecemeal with their investment, and it was a pretty ramshackle enterprise, at least for the first 10 years or so.
Josh Shepard, I'm wondering already, like, was there a discussion of who was supposed to pay for this? Like, did they try to charge the students, or was it already, was it more innocent and pure at this time that it was just a big experiment and it was going to be free? It was going to be subsidized by these institutions.
So you'd be shocked at how affordable or free a lot of these state institutions were before World War II. A lot of these institutions were state subsidized, or there would just be almost like fees, but not tuition at the time. So it was largely a free service of the progressive era, of the end of the progressive era, pre-New Deal that was emerging. And they... the concept was, as I write in the book, equal access to education. So by the mid-1920s, as a philosophy around universities doing broadcasting began to formulate, their idea was, well, everyone in the state should have the same exact education regardless of location, and technology will help with that. And so especially in Wisconsin, they had something called the Wisconsin Idea. And that became a sort of philosophical system for a lot of R1, as they call them, Research One universities. So big research state schools from then on is that if there is a service that the university can provide, how can we strategically reach every possible listener so that those are met, so those goals are met?
I don't know if Eric may have been also wondering kind of about the cost of the radio equipment. I know from my own research building radio stations at the time, when I look at some of the numbers, it's kind of eye-popping. And in some cases, you know, schools or students may, I'm thinking about Haverford College, where I'm doing a lot of research about the 1920s. And I know that students there were reaching out to alums to help pay for the radio equipment because it was so expensive. So at these, at schools like Wisconsin, how did they pay for the building of these radio stations? And was it, you know, a challenge to get buy-in for that from administrators?
So, yeah. Okay. So that it really was a great challenge at most schools. I named some of the successful ones that I look at in the book, but I would say the majority of colleges and universities who had any interest in this at all couldn't build the facilities. They didn't understand how to even begin in a lot of cases. And then if it was implemented in the really early days, the 1920s, it was often what they called amateurs who were building up the station at the time, who had previously done the point-to-point broadcasting or distance listening. And so a lot of hobbyists actually did help to build the very early infrastructure before schools realized the PR potential of having a radio station and who that reaches. And then from there, obviously, the funds were pretty scrappy. It did have to come sometimes from donations. I'm not aware of every history about that. Or in some cases, they were lucky and the state did want to increase facilities and access points for education, like Ohio and like Wisconsin. And actually, the money did come from the state, at least to some extent. But what you really see in the early days is, in some cases, people actually built their own equipment from scratch, which is fascinating. And they would actually, they had something called a vacuum tube, which is this giant glass thing. And they would actually blow their own vacuum tubes. They would learn to blow glass to like build these early facilities. And in other cases, they just had to rely on renting commercial station facilities and so they'd have like mixed dial, you know, access during the day. Or sometimes it was even, in very rare cases, shortwave. And so it'd be a shortwave kind of like redistribution of sound a little bit later. That would be a little bit later than the early 20s. But yeah, there are all these experiments in how to reach audiences that were based upon either the abundance or lack of what was available.
I love your DIY stories, because I've been running across some of those too. At Haverford in the 1920s at WABQ, for the tower, they had a windmill that had been donated. And so they put the windmill, I guess, yeah, like oriented in a strange way, but they used a windmill, which I thought was pretty funny. So I also think it's interesting.
Did they move the windmill, or they just climbed the existing windmill?
No, it was donated from somebody else. So the windmill was then attached to the roof of the
A recycled windmill into a radio tower.
Yeah, repurposed. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So it's interesting to me the way some of these early radio stations in the 20s are starting to connect with each other and collaborate. And so, Josh, you talk about the Association of College and University Broadcasting Stations, which is probably pretty obscure to most people, ACUBS, and that was formed in 1925, I believe. Can you talk about how that came to be, and you know, why did stations start to organize at that time?
Yeah, so there's a precursory answer and then an answer to this. And the precursory answer is that a lot of the history had framed the emergence of non-commercial media as in direct conflict with commercial media at all times. And so to some extent, you know, you see people beginning from this point that, you know, by the 1920s, you have the educators on one side, and then you have the commercial broadcasters on the other side. And really, it's a kind of a more mixed story, because the educational broadcasters, by their own words, had no idea what they were doing. And I think that's actually the starting point to this history, is that there was some antagonism over what they called frequency scarcity. So there are only so many openings per city or area on certain AM bands. And so there was absolutely conflict over who gets those, and the commercial broadcasters wanted them. But they weren't necessarily against education, from what I've seen in the letters. So you get an ACUBS, which becomes renamed the National Association of Educational Broadcasters, or NAEB, in 34, which then becomes the institution that builds NPR and PBS in the 1960s. But they, in the early days, they formed as like a clearinghouse to talk about best practices. So like, what programs are you doing? What's working with the audiences on write-in campaigns? You know, where do you put the mic compared to your face? Like, they literally ask these very technical, simple questions. How do you keep people listening? You know, and that kind of stuff. So about 1925, I would say even up to about 32 or 33, a pretty long time for a clearinghouse structure, there's just a lot of confusion. And a lot of reporting about experiments in that period is they're saying, well, there's these policies that are happening in DC. What are they? We don't even know. We don't understand them, which is to get the Radio Act in 27. They're having conversations about like the music appreciation shows in particular, which seem to be the ones that are most appreciated by the listeners. You know, how do you incorporate curriculum from a school district right into a broadcast and make it listenable? So these very, very basic things are being discussed through the ACUBS without necessarily a vision that pulls them together. It's actually the activist trade groups that McChesney writes about in his book that give voice and concept to what they're doing. And that's about the early 1930s, by my take.
And for McChesney's book, Telecommunications. I don't have the citation in front of me. This is Professor Robert McChesney, who wrote a book about really that period before the Federal Radio Act and then before the Telecommunications Act in 1934, contesting that received history up until the 90s, really, that folks just assumed commercial broadcasting was the natural end, the natural state of broadcasting in the United States, and that its establishment had been relatively uncontested, and his history and political economic analysis of that time greatly complicated that and said, no, indeed, there was quite a bit of activism that you just cited around whether or not commercial radio or non-commercial radio would be present and or predominant. So I just want to provide a little bit of that background for folks who haven't taken a course in political economy. But what I wanted to come in and sort of ask you about or talk to you about is, you know, you sort of mentioned how the universities at the time, in many ways, didn't have a clear picture about what they were doing. Hence the need, in some cases, for them to unify around discussing what are just basic techniques around broadcasting. Mm-hmm. And there's a great story, I think, that underlines this in your book about a visiting dignitary from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Company, which in many cases is thought of as one of the great success stories in state-sponsored and public media, who toured many of the educational stations. and who had very withering reviews of their programming and their approach.
Like detuned pianos. He was irritated by detuned pianos.
and yet, he ended up having a lot of influence. I would love if you could fill in some of the details and why this person from the BBC, why his visit and then his very negative reviews of what he encountered. Why is that important in the development of these university broadcasters that ultimately evolve into public broadcasting?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So what happens is in 1934, the Communications Act has two choices as it's being deliberated upon. It's going to either be something by which all possible groups are given ownership access to frequency allocations, or it's going to end up sort of ratifying an infrastructure that's already in place. And so what they did was they decided at the senatorial level that the pre-ownership of the facilities, so just the capacity to reach an audience and that the audience is listening because they have vaudeville performers or something, is in fact the American system that we have and qualifies as what they even called diversity at the time, the diversity of different corporations to be able to own access points within the United States. And they qualify that as what they call public interest, convenience, and necessity. So that is basically the underlying logic of the American FCC allocation delegation system to today. The entire system is built around public interest. And what that translates to is technical mastery without any sense of content or any sense of public service. So what happens is in 34 is they have so much more money in the corporate side. They have so much more talent, honestly, on the corporate side, as far as radio is concerned, that almost 70% of educational stations lost their licenses. And this has been a big talking point in media history research for a long time, is how could a university or school district be told, no, you're not allowed to reach students or farmers with their classes. Okay, so that's the springboard on that. What happens is in the next couple years after that the book is concerned with, is that they say, well, how can we make educational broadcasting better and how can we change the policy? And so what that requires is the study of best practices from someone who actually understood the best practices. And the Rockefeller Foundation is invited to begin to fund research into this area, which leads to this almost like intellectual explosion about media research per se that I detail in especially chapter 4 of the book. And one of their strategies was to go to commercial broadcasters and give internships, as well as bring over this guy named Charles Seatman from the BBC. And he was the director of talks after Hilda Matheson, and he had run afoul of John Reith, the very famous overseer of and developer of the BBC. And they just didn't get along personally. And what happens is the Rockefeller Foundation sends over a young Edward R. Murrow to learn enunciation practices at the BBC. And he goes back to the Rockefeller Foundation and says, there's this guy. And he's extremely liberal or left, you know, by the standards, and they don't like it at the BBC, and they're going to like fire him or move him around somewhere. And could he come back to the States and they consult with our colleagues at these stations who are fledgling, losing all the policy battles? They themselves don't feel like they understand what they're doing with the mics. And they have this organization that they formed to talk about it. So they send Seatman to the States, and he absolutely despises what he finds at every single university that he goes to. And he was so upset about the amount of travel time between the college towns and then what he would find at the end of there, that he would like insult people's weight in his writing. It's back to the Rockefeller Foundation. He would say they didn't talk well, just like in interpersonal conversations. He would just like have these very cutting and scathing reviews, not only of the station practices, but of the people who were the stewards of the concept of educational media. But the irony was when he was with them personally, that he would like show them how to have a good broadcast. They would simulate broadcasts. He would say, here's what you need for that transmitter to make sure it reaches the longest possible space. And he actually becomes this hero in the process of disparaging them back to New York in the Rockefeller Foundation. But his writings are so disparaging that they actually remove all the funding for educators until the 1950s, almost till the Ford Foundation steps in. But so he sort of like trash talks them and becomes their hero at the ACUBS and then NAEB, same organization, in the process. So he actually becomes, in a way, like, I don't know, like the great mentor of the transitional period of trial and error experimentation towards what becomes NPR and PBS. And sorry, go ahead. Yep.
Yeah, Josh, it sounds to me like I can't trust this guy from the BBC, that he sounds like a snob and that he was rude. He was mad that the United States existed. If he's mad that it's too big.
But that's what the BBC was like.
My question is, should I trust anything he has to say at all? Or is he an unreliable narrator in this case? Like, did he have a good point, or was he a jerk?
Yeah, there's one anecdote that I actually start the whole book with in the intro. There's only one guy he likes on the entire tour, and it's the University of Iowa in Iowa City. And Iowa State actually becomes one of the major institutions up through the 1960s, but Iowa City was not at the time. And he's named Carl Menzer. And Carl Menzer basically had to run the station all alone. He apparently had a boss who hated him personally and would pick on him and like bully him in the studio. And, you know, as is true today, you know, stations just have to keep a certain number of hours on the air or they lose their licenses. So Menzer would pick up a violin and he would just play for 2-3 hours at a time by himself, the fiddle. You know, he would fiddle himself for 2 or 3 hours at a time. But he had, during that time, he would think about like, how can I make this work? Because in 10, 15 years, this is probably going to be a big thing. And Menzer and Seatman really hit it off. And Seatman writes these terrible things about his boss, but Menzer has this idea. And his idea is, what if we began to just trade one good broadcast with every station between the stations? Like, what if we could just, like, my pals in Minnesota through the ACUBS, my pals in, you know, wherever, in Illinois, like, what if we just, like, sent each other a broadcast? And he, after the Communications Act, begins to experiment with all the different distribution mechanisms. He becomes that figure who does that. And Seatman thinks that this guy's like a genius, like that he has seen 30 years into the future how the American system is probably going to work, which is a decentralized, university-produced set of educational entertainment broadcasts that were of quality, that could then give the auspice of what the time they called a fourth network, because there was, you know, NBC, CBS, ABC, and then public media would have been the fourth network before cable, you know. So that's the one person that, and in fact, Menzer and Seatman and these other early influencers do build the early infrastructure for NPR and PBS about 20 years down the line.
So I loved, this is all really fascinating to me. And I love that there was this guy who toured a bunch of university stations. It's right up my alley, although I'm not mean to people. I'm curious, like, how many radio stations did he visit? And were they all ostensibly educational stations? Like, were there any student-run stations in that mix by any chance? Or were they all more of what we think of as, you know, trying to do this educational extension-like programming?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially which I have read your work with interest, as you know, about the differences between educational and college radio in the foundational days. So from what I can tell from the documents that exist still, right, the extant archival documents, they sent them to like somewhere between 12 and 14 stations and that included CBS and NBC, which he thought were great, by the way, just in terms of the aesthetics of the broadcasts. And the rest were like, you could just imagine like a train going from New York through Pennsylvania, through Ohio, you know, all the way. And he ends up in Oregon, actually, and then he comes back around. And so it was mostly stations that they hoped at the Rockefeller Foundation could then emulate a BBC model. That seed is planted really early in the thinking of non-commercial media, even though it begins more as correspondence classes than it does as cultural uplift programming or whatever they would have called it. So I did not see anything about college radio in particular. And I'm going to stop on that point because I'm going to defer to you. How much you might know about this.
Yeah, I mean, and then by the 1930s, I think there really isn't much student-run radio. That's sort of a quiet period before we get carrier current stations starting, you know, mid to late 30s at the earliest. You know, so Haverford's student-run station, WABQ, was part of ACUBS in the 1920s. And to me, that was interesting. You know, so now we're going back like another 10 years or so, that group of stations seems a bit broader than maybe what you see in the 1930s, I'm guessing, like a, more of a mixture. And probably that's more the case of radio in the 20s to begin with, that it's more of a lively crew.
Is that an artifact of the Telecommunications Act of 1934, right? Because that sort of sets up spectrum scarcity. So on the one hand, and therefore, if a station, you know, had not been a university station, especially a student-run station, hadn't already been established prior to 1934, it probably would have been just difficult without the capital. Also, given the bias in a way that Josh has mentioned in the system of the preference towards a well-funded, popular, you know, listen, you know, popular with audiences kind of station versus something that might be amateur and run by students. Josh, do you think that it is probably perhaps somewhat to blame for the lag in college, like student run college radio stations being built or coming to the fore in that kind of period after 1934?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of wisdom about the college aspect of this, although I am a proud alumni of 12 years of college radio across undergraduate and graduate school broadcasting and did an eccentric music show for a lot of years. But I'm not totally sure about that. But here's the thing, though, is that what the book does look at and is really actually very focused on, in my mind, is what happens after 34 in terms of an activism or media reform movement to recapture the airwaves so that they become more democratic and expand equal access to education by technology. And in a way, like, that is a book about strategy. It's a book about the strategies that were followed, what worked and what didn't, and then the consequent policies that would change as strategies worked or didn't, you know, over time. So that is sort of like the tenor of it. And then as stations do begin to get more frequencies, it tends to happen for two reasons. The first is the introduction of FM. So there's less competition, and then the introduction of television, by which the commercial networks were less interested in radio as the profit source. And then I think you do begin to see less pushback in terms of who gets to own what, until religious stations, you know, begin to emerge. And that's where the college stations get their opening. I think that a lot of the college station openings come as there's just more channels available, and they're less, you know, contested in terms of profit versus state-based, not state-based in a propaganda way, state ownership or state reaching models in public media, in proto-public media.
Right, and that really is the FM dial, because that is with the creation of FM broadcasting, there is a specific set aside for non-commercial activity, right? Mm-hmm. And which did not exist prior to the creation of FM.
Right, exactly.
You are listening to Radio Survivor, and that we're here with our guest Josh Shepard, who's recently published the book Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Josh is assistant professor of media studies at University of Colorado Boulder. And this is Radio Survivor. My name is Eric Klein. With me are my co-hosts, Jennifer Waits and Paul Rees-Mindell.
So we're kind of moving forward in time here, Josh. And so we've been talking a lot about educational radio, and how do people's conception of educational radio, how does that shift to public radio? And when do we start talking about even that term public radio?
Yeah, I think so. The end of Robert McChesney's book, which is Telecommunications, Mass Media, and Democracy, really paints two things. One is that there was a different vision for media besides free markets. And I think that's true. And then on the other side, he sort of makes this argument that it ends in 34 with the Communications Act and the 70% loss of frequencies that we mentioned before. But what I found in the archives over about 6 years of archive work, about 10 years from dissertation to book, you know, was that it actually galvanized, the Communications Act actually galvanized the people in McChesney's book to build an alternative system. And so what you begin to see after the Communications Act is this interest from sectors who were not previously interested. You get the philanthropic sector jumping in to help fund research into improving educational broadcasting. That creates the foundation for philanthropy now with public media. That starts in the 30s. You get the Office of Education begins to step in. And I talk a lot about the federal progressive level, the FDR, you know, New Deal interest in equal access to education. The FCC, this is a common misconception about them. They didn't exist before 34. They were formed by the act, and they were then tasked within its first year to regulate, as a regulating agency, the senatorial rules that were given to them, which is why they are kind of the bad guy in the, you know, I think McChesney's right about that, but they literally were just like a new non-deliberative body. And they had to implement frequency allocations in line with the rules they were given. But within a year, they are trying to figure out ways to get educators more allocations. So they, even within the FCC, there's like this activist thing going on behalf of non-commercial media and especially education. And then you also get this grassroots bottom-up movement that I think community radio emblematizes to today. So for me, like, the legacy of this great period of media reform is more in community media than NPR, for example, which I see as a very nervous sector that's always responding to politics and even how it reports. Whereas community media, there is this sense that access and communication and community building are essential to technology and media technology, period. Right? That is the goal. The goal is not merely accumulation alone. So yeah, and what happens is by, you know, the mid-late 1930s, there's this all-out multi-sector movement in which different groups are moving in parallel towards recapturing those frequencies if they can, and they're developing all kinds of, like I said before, strategies around it. One is, how do you distribute good programming? How do you make good programming? And then how do you even research to know when education is actually working through technology? How do you even like understand if after a student hears a broadcast that they've learned the lesson? And that actually becomes, I think, one of the more unexpected parts of the book is the emergence of communications research, which I did not see coming when I began the project. So yeah, I hope that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that leads right into, because I was going to ask you about communications research, and that was a surprise to me as I was reading the book too. Like, to get to that point, like, wow, you know, attaching a lot of importance to trying to understand what's going on with radio, that leads to this whole new discipline. So definitely talk more about that for us, about how that came to be.
Well, yeah, it's because the listenership is so inclined towards this kind of story, there's a lot of things I don't have to say, I think, about what radio does, which is, you know, it is quite close to people. It's something very intimate that people have in their personal lives. It is something also that can supplement something you're doing in your house, right? It does simultaneously, you're driving and all these kind of things that we think about in this sector. And what happens is, from a, you know, a research perspective, they would have seen that as something what they would have called like stimuli. It's a stimuli. What's the relationship between a stimulation or an affectation and an action or reception? So Rockefeller funds this one project called, they call Project 15, and it hires these early young researchers, a guy named Paul Lazarsfeld, a guy named Hadley Cantrell, and another guy named Theodore Adorno, and then another guy named Frank Stanton. So Adorno's a very famous philosopher and is eventually kicked off the project. But Frank Stanton goes on to be president of CBS, and Lazarsfeld founds the discipline of communication studies, essentially, with his research on this. And they're tasked with that question of who, when they're listening, understands and who doesn't, and why. And that seems like an almost impossible question to answer when you've never actually developed a methodology for that. It was a ground zero moment for the methodology. And what they find is that if they combine social psychological, so mass psychology research, which was also new at the time, with early advertising research, which was really rudimentary, like just like age, sex, gender, did you like it? You know, that kind of thing for advertising, that they were able to account for what we would now think about as demographic research. And demography is essentially public policy. So presidential approval ratings, all these things use that same method. Advertisers, pre and post development, survey research for products, same methodology. And they are able to expand the categories of affiliation within that first year of research, which is around 1937. And suddenly, once they have all of these categories established beyond the rudimentary categories, they can break people apart, not just in terms of preference, but they can actually unify different types of locations based upon the associations with the demography. Okay, I'm going to put that in the simpler terms, which is to say someone in New Jersey and someone in Montana, in the earliest form of this research, would have been separated from each other. What do people in New Jersey think? What do people in Montana think? But when you go from three categories of affiliation to like 20, you can say, okay, this type of person, this embodiment in Montana and New Jersey have the same belief system, and they actually turn out to respond similarly to content, to whatever they're listening to, more than simply the location alone or the sex or, you know, alone that they're affiliated with. So what happens is this does something really weird with the history, which is you can begin to predict people's behavior based upon the demographic categories that they've been associated with. So suddenly within the first year, they say, okay, we've not only figured out how to divide students based upon reception to information and if they can take the tests, but we actually seem to have discovered this methodology that could be implemented very quickly. It's a fast methodology. You take the survey, you know, and then you have this data about the question asked, and we can predict how people are going to behave. And the government loves it, uses it for propaganda research during World War II for the OWI. Schools love it because it actually becomes one of the foundations of standardized testing. There's some correlate that goes on at the Rockefeller Foundation with that at the time. And then it becomes the foundation of all advertising research that we still use today, and then consequently the communications programs. So the question of how do we figure out if educational broadcasting is in fact educational accidentally engenders an entire subdiscipline of research that becomes academic departments in 1947, starting with the University of Illinois and then, or NYU. There's some debate over which one started quicker, NYU or Illinois. But from there, and then their first test is really famous, which was War of the Worlds, because Frank Stanton was working for CBS. And that was the big takeaway, is not just a huge cultural event, but it was actually the first event where they could triangulate response across geographic regions, as opposed to just in a localized way. And they found that different demographic categories responded similarly to the panic. And as Michael Sokolow and Jeff Pooley have written, it's nowhere near the number of people that panicked that they thought, but it was enough to show that triangulation was possible, which then of course influences early sociology, quantitative sociology. So quantitative sociology research also is partly born out of this moment as well. So how galvanized were people about non-commercial media? I mean, they literally started to invent ways of investigating audiences that are used by almost every sector in the world at this point, you know? So it was a big moment.
And these are ideas we sort of all take for granted, even if we think about them in sort of more mundane terms of, you know, a newspaper article about, you know, the Taylor Swift effect and Swifties, right? I mean, that's essentially a demographic category, which, you know, advertisers are interested in, obviously, and you know, spurs a lot of investment and research as well. You know, so, I mean, you know, it's almost nearly mundane to us today, because I think we've all been trained to think about audiences in this fashion, but it had to start somewhere. And it's interesting that you've sort of triangulated that start. I think a really fascinating part of I think what you lay out this history in your book, Josh Shepard, Shadow of the New Deal, is that you set up this idea, and you've sort of hinted at it here in our discussion. There's sort of activism and advocacy, right? And the activists, of course, were pushing very hard for more of the a certain type of public interest in broadcasting, to have public interest broadcasting, what would eventually become public broadcasting. And then it seems to me that then you also have advocates who are basically building it. Is that a too simple of a gloss? The folks who were in the 50s, you know, putting transmitters on the air, figuring out ways to bicycle tapes about, to bicycle records about, to exchange programming, going into the practice of public broadcasting, absent, any sort of governmentally mandated system.
Yeah, it was kind of a return of the philosophy major moment in the book, which was, how do we think about what happens mm-hmm. in this history? And what does it tell us about what a public is and what, you know, and how it's shaped and why it's shaped the way it is and how it's different from commercial media? So we have this unusual situation in this country where it's very idiosyncratic in that it begins with essentially a double failure of educators, which is they didn't know what they were doing and they didn't have the support, and the regulation cuts them off before they can figure it out. And then they have to figure out how to rebound. And so what they did have at the time, especially from the very late 20s, like 29 until like 34, were these trade groups. And I don't expect anyone to know what they were called. They were called the National Committee for Education by Radio, for example. And they articulated these visions for why non-commercial media are important. And they would frame it in terms of lobby. And they actually did influence a couple senators to pose bills for set aside frequencies before the Communications Act of 34. Those bills failed. And but they're able to articulate and kind of like exemplify in a trade group structure what it was that made this crucial compared to just simply owning the wires that AT&T with RCA owned or something like that. So after 34, these trade groups are essentially mired in total failure. So for me, they were like activist groups that were doing good work, but it was largely rhetorical. And then after 34, the same people, this is what I love about the story, were like, well, that didn't work at all. But what if we like built our own network mm-hmm. that just didn't have a profit logic? What if we had a non-advertising network? And you see two emerge. One is called the University Broadcasting Council in Chicago. And that leads two of its stewards, which was Robert Hutchins and William Benton, to go on to then found parts of the Ford Foundation, which then supports NET, National Educational Television, later. That's Hutchins. And Benton becomes a senator in Connecticut and founds Encyclopedia Britannica. And he actually writes the first bill that gives educational frequencies to television in 52. So they're inspired by this, but it fails in Chicago too. But the other one's Rocky Mountain Radio Council, where I'm out in Colorado now. I used to be in D.C., and that's a guy named A.G. Crane, and he was in the National Committee of Education, or National Committee of Education by Radio, NCER. And he says, well, I'm just going to like build an alternative system. I don't like this public interest mandate. I think this is a failure of democracy. So I'm just going to call what I'm doing as a spoof public radio. And he actually founds the term public broadcasting service, public radio. And so the nomenclature for all public media is actually from Colorado, from this activist who, what I say, turns into an advocate. And what I mean by advocate is system building, not merely responding to things after they've happened and then, you know, raising awareness alone. But like, what does it mean to build the infrastructure so that 10, 15 years after you're gone, that you have posterity? And I also, you know, like I said at the beginning, this is kind of a lefty book in a way about maybe a liberal history or something like that. Which is to say, like, I'm very concerned about the way that the left is always behind in everything as a lefty. So, like, well, what examples do we have of activist movements that succeeded? And what is, like, the political economic shape of that? You know, and that was one of the occupations, it's an academic-y kind of thing, but it's one of the occupations that kept me in the archive all these years. So what I have this, like, theory about activism and advocacy, and it's not meant to be an objective theory. It's more of like a thought experiment, which is activism often makes things conspicuous that have already happened or need to be made aware to people who are present. Whereas like an advocacy is actually something more like a system building approach by which machinations within a contradictory system, so a system that's inequitous by nature, begin to take reform structures that allow for change later. So in other words, I'm being very careful with the words here because I don't think it always works. I mean, that's the whole point. Or if it does work, there's concessions along the way that water down what the activism might have intended in the first place. And so what's the goal, right? What's the goal? So is our goal on the left simply to make things aware as they're happening, already happened? Or is there something else? And one of the conclusions I came to from reading Phenomenology, which is really nerdy, is that it's actually the mundane practice by which you no longer have to advocate that is the conclusion of the process. The conclusion of the process isn't awareness. It's everyday life and banality. And so that's what the book tries to chronicle, is like this big loss in 34 that lead to the success that is actually a sustainable institution. And I see institutions not as institutions aren't the solution, but they're a strategy. So that's right. One of the other arguments of the book is that institutional activism and advocacy is one route that a discourse can take for its view. It's not necessarily the final goal.
I'm very sympathetic to your view, and I will express my sympathy by sort of taking your same analysis and shoving it forward into the latter part of the 20th century, because I think that it applies very well to a smaller phenomenon, which is the establishment of low-power FM. Hmm. I mean, low-power FM is essentially born out of loss. In 1978, when the FCC, under pressure from lobbying, including the Commercial Broadcasters, National Public Radio, and the National Association, National Federation of Community Broadcasters, ended the licensure of Class D 10-watt educational radio stations, which were established as part of the non-commercial set-aside, and were primarily used by smaller educational organizations, high schools, community colleges, etc. Mm-hmm. Out of a sense of scarcity, in the sense that both scarcity from the standpoint of spectrum and also funding, having to compete for funding resources, that was what led the arguments to put these stations aside, to stop licensing them on the one hand, and two, making it the case that the stations would have to relocate. They basically had an upgrade or die kind of mandate, that if someone came looking for your frequency, you would have to give it up. So at which point now, maybe I think there are two existing Class D stations now currently broadcasting. But in all of that, and the arguments about it sound very much like the Siemens from the BBC, his take on educational radio, the arguments were the broadcasting is amateurish. Yeah, Class D stations. It's often replicating, say, pop music programming, but not as well as on the pop music stations. Mm-hmm. Not as much service, et cetera, et cetera. Those are arguments. But that in turn ends up being the impetus for what became the free radio movement, right? The micropower radio movement in the 90s as consolidation hit and radio activists realized, well, wait, we can't get an inexpensive, low-powered station on the air. Like, we're simply prevented by policy from doing so. Mm. So the part of the activism, the civil disobedience, was people creating, you know, what we call pirate radio stations. But it's also a moment in which activists seize the opportunity with the FCC, which is dealing with the problem, to say, well, maybe it's time to create a service which is more accessible, less expensive, and we'll serve these different populations, you know, basically, instead of prohibition, let's legalize it, but then in a way in which we can control it, is just how, you know, roughly we end up with low power FM today. And I think that there is that mix again of there's the activism, but within that there was advocacy. There was the building of organizations. You may have heard of the Prometheus Radio Project, mm-hmm. but as well, there's Common Frequency, and the United Church of Christ became very involved as a nationwide institution in the advocacy for low power FM, but also then helping to build the infrastructure that was somewhat needed to help build out all these stations. And I think we've seen this time and again, and why I like it, and what I liked about Robert McChesney's, you know, first book, Telecommunications, Mass Media and Democracy, right, is that it reframes things from always having to be a policy argument Policy obviously is important. Policy was necessary in these things, right, for the creation of public broadcasting. But practice and the creation of things is also very important. So, you know, not a philosopher by training. So I'm going to speak in terms that perhaps are more gross and less specific. But, you know, I think that as I read through your book and came to the conclusion, you know, I see this is an example of these same stories and helps to address, I think, or at least I'm underlining the problem that you cited of you know, the left. Is it just activism? Are we just bringing attention to things, or can we really bring things into some sort of practice and practice? Does my gloss, given what you know, sorry, not to put you on the spot or make you grade me as if I were turning in my third year essay to you, Professor Shepherd, but does that make any sense to you, my kind of application of your theory as I understand it?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing I'd really just like to focus on that you say there is that policy is not the same thing as the law, right? So, you know, a policy applies to the form of an institution, the structure of how a law resonates, you know, and then how we live and how we practice within those conditions around us. So, you know, policies sort of ossify certain beliefs and practices that then have to be repeated or resembled, you know, by those who are adherents to the specific policy. So in other words, yeah, I think it's similar. Yeah, that's good.
Hey, so that's the voice of Josh Shepherd, who is the author of the new book, Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Josh, we have about 2 minutes left here on Radio Survivor on the radio program. And you said something right at the top of today's interview an hour ago that the idea, the concept of public radio, when it was first being imagined into being in the United States, was that it was not for big audiences. And that set off really interesting. It tickled my brain because to be a little bit tongue in cheek, but also maybe I'm being very serious, that sounds completely un-American to me, that there would be radio for a few people. And like, was that the case 100 years ago? Was that idea so strange? Is it, am I having difficulty with accepting that idea as being real because I live in the 21st century, or has that always been controversial?
Wow. So, I mean, the distinction there would have probably been the national went from what we would now think of as the I-95 corridor, like, you know, like Richmond up to Maine, basically, west, you know, think of the railroads expanding west. So there was a concept of networked centralized radio that you get from NBC Red and Blue, you know, and they had all the talent, they had the money, they had RCA, GE, United Fruit, who had the patents, you know, AT&T, NBC. It was remarkable, really. And then localism, right? And a provinciality of serving a local community. And that was really, truly true from the Midwest all the way to the West until after the post-war era. So I think like part of the story is like which part of the country and what were their needs, and then how did the technology really appeal to them in what they felt that their needs were, as these two simultaneous models are coming into conflict with each other in the 1930s, so local and national.
Well, that's going to conclude today's radio program. We're going to continue the conversation on our podcast, which is available wherever you get your podcasts, or at radiosurvivor.com. You can email us. Our email address is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. My name is Eric Klein. On behalf of Jennifer Waitz and Paul Reese Mendel, thank you so much for listening. And now, Josh.